and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Anne Holsinger, Managing Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Our guest today is Kirk Bloodsworth, the first death row prisoner exonerated by DNA evidence. In the 30 years since his exoneration, he has become an advocate for criminal legal reform. He played a key role in ending the death penalty in Maryland and served as executive director to Witness to Innocence, the only national organization of death row exonerees and their families, from 2018 to 2022. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Bloodsworth.
Pleasure to be here, no matter what, you know.
June 28th marked the 30th anniversary of your exoneration from Maryland's death row. For our listeners who are unfamiliar with the details of your case, could you give us a short overview?
Sure. In 1984, a little girl by the name of Dawn Phenice Hamilton was found brutally murdered in a wooded area near our home. A search ensued for the person responsible for this, and the description was as follows: 6'5", curly blonde hair, bushy mustache, tan skin, and skinny. As it turned out, I was about 6 foot tall. My hair was as red as the squares on the DPIC sign. You know, and I'm a redhead. I don't tan. They got it wrong, and they got it wrong from the beginning. I mean, you know, two jurors and two different prosecutors and two judges and all the police force in Baltimore County were dead wrong. The only person was right was me.
And what was it that eventually led to your exoneration?
Well, I read a book by Joseph Wongball called Bloody. And the first time that DNA was ever used in a criminal case was, you know, depicted in his book. And to make a long story short, it was about the Narborough killings over in England. I read this with deep fascination. And back then, when I read the book, you needed like 10 head hairs and all this different blood sample and everything. So progressively, it got more easier to do. And Caris Mullis, who is the Nobel Prize winning geneticist who figured it out, came up with PCR. And basically, that's a test of exclusion. You're not. And everybody was telling me, you got to do the DNA, send the DNA in. And finally, we found something. We had her underclothes sent to Dr. Edward Blake in California. As it turned out, he found not only one, but agreed. And then the FBI found another spot of semen that was not mine. And they, you know, that's how I was cleared. It's a tragedy. And to say anything of this child's death, she lived 9 years, but boy, she certainly changed the lives of a lot of people. As it turned out, in the end, we caught the real killer based on a CODIS database hit of the real killer. And he was already in prison, Kimberly mm-hmm. Shea Ruffner. And by the way, and he was not 6'5". He was only 5'6", 60 pounds. So, you know, witness identification is one of the most problematic pieces of evidence to just place a person to death, and that's basically what happened.
Many years after your exoneration in 2004, Congress passed the Innocence Protection Act, which included a program named for you that was intended to help states pay for post-conviction DNA testing. What was your role in getting that legislation passed, and did it have the effect that you hoped for?
Well, you know, it certainly has, you know, gotten over 50 people out of prison based on that program and, you know, free from death rows and all over the country. I mean, obviously there's a lot more inside prisons, but they don't get tested. You know, they've had samples from back when, and the program is amazing. And I hope it continues because it's very important to Bloodsworth Grant.
What kinds of obstacles are faced by current death row prisoners during the post-conviction relief process, especially those who are seeking DNA evidence?
Well, once they slam the door on you as a human being, you don't have much of a choice for any type of study. And if you have actual claims of innocence, you know, you have to jump through all these proverbial hoops in life, and you shouldn't have to do that. You know, if you're sentenced to death and or been under a whatever sentence, it doesn't matter if, you know, 5 years or whatever, and there's evidence to prove your innocence, you shouldn't have to wait. And it's really, you know, because the prosecutions don't want to change their story, even though the evidence changes it for them. And I think that's, you know, a lot of prosecutors probably disagree with me. Why won't you do it? And, you know, they declare all kinds of different things that doesn't make any sense to me or any other death row.
What kind of challenges did you face upon your exoneration? And in general, do you think that death row exonerees have sufficient resources available to them when they're released?
I don't think that death row exonerees have. It's a lot better now than it was, of course. But, you know, we should be bending over backwards and trying to figure out why that these people, you know, suffered the slings and arrows of the criminal justice system only to get, you know, hit and skewered by these things and by the criminal justice system itself because they're in denial. You know, that's the one part about the adversarial system, that it's adversarial to the truth. And not the truth that is portrayed by either side necessarily, but the truth. And DNA does that. And unfortunately, the death penalty doesn't have it for every case. And people were executed that have been innocent or that are innocent, I'm sure.
Do you think there are particular challenges faced by people who are being exonerated from death row versus from the general prison population?
I think if you're innocent, you're innocent. It doesn't matter what sentence you got. You don't belong there. So the challenge is you've done all this time now. Somebody did 40 some years. I can't even fathom. I did almost 9 and it'd like to kill me for something you didn't do. And that's the only thing that keeps you upright. And it is a challenge. You can't get there. I mean, there's innocence projects now that handle this kind of thing, but there's not enough people to do the work. I mean, you know, you have to reinvestigate a case at most times. And, you know, it's a lot of things you have to go through in order to get it done. We've come a long ways, but we've got a long way to go.
One of the things that you worked on a lot after exoneration was the abolition of the death penalty in Maryland. Could you talk a little bit about the role you played in that?
See, in 1993, it got out. So I was, pushing to get me and Jane Henderson and others and Stephanie Joseph and all these different people and the Maryland Citizens Against Sanctioned State Executions and Jane Henderson and all those people. And I can't sit here and name them all. There's so many exonerees alike. I was on commissions. It took 20 some years in 2000. It took 20 years. 2013, we passed it by a landslide. And thanks to Jamie Raskin as the champion on the floor, the Senate, and it went right through. At least for now, no one will be executed that are innocent. I think my case shines as an example of why. You know, they keep saying, well, we have DNA now. We can print it. No, it doesn't matter. You know, you can't turn an apple into an orange. It'll always be an apple. And I think that's what innocence is all about. It's always going to be about that. The person did not do it. And with that sitting in the way, it has to be. And that's what I did. They mentioned my case and my name over 60 times during the hearings. Jamie Raskin, bless his heart. And I I'm pretty happy at it. You know, we ended in Connecticut, and I was there, and Delaware, and Washington State, and New Mexico, and all these different places. I didn't physically go to New Mexico, but New Jersey, and, you know, the death penalty had to go. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but it's 190, the death for retirees now, right?
It's actually 192 now.
Okay. See, it's just like every day. You know, if there was a bunch of planes or a plane that 192 people were killed, we would have the greatest amount of investigations on this, and we haven't had it. And, you know, and honestly, the vitriol, we have presidents that have executed 13 people right in a row and just be nonchalant about, well, you know, they say they did it. Well, I had two jurors and you know, and two judges, and all of them said I did it too, but they were wrong. I mean, how can, you know, 24 plus this police department and plus Baltimore County Police Department and all these judges be wrong? And look, they withheld evidence about another suspect in my case for 2 years and didn't tell anybody. Now, he wasn't the real killer, but that doesn't matter. I mean, it's information about someone else just because they didn't think so, and the real killer was right under their nose. And I'll tell you something else, Ann. Had we, the police report about this guy, Ruffner, came into 8 days before I was arrested. Nobody went back to check on that guy because they were looking for blood work because they had blood in his name, and they just got fascinated because I was just a new person living in Baltimore County at the time. But, you know, and I think that's how simplistic it was. They just would not believe anything else other than their narrative, and that's what causes this issue. So the death penalty's got to go, federal and state in the country. And I know it's no low-picking fruit now, but people got to realize, you know, I would rather send a man to life in prison than executing him for something he didn't do. I don't want to send him there for life in prison if he didn't do it either, but at least he won't die, or she.
You mentioned the 192 people who've been exonerated from death row, and in the time since you were exonerated, 28 of those have been based on DNA evidence. How do you think that those exonerations and the growing awareness of the problem of innocence has affected people's views on the death penalty?
Well, I think it's obvious, but, you know, it's just like anything else. I thought that I was trash to people. People didn't want to talk about me and some of the vitriol that was on the radio and news. And like when I got a new trial, I remember some news reporter saying, and now so good, you shouldn't be allowed to say that crap. You don't know. You don't know. And honestly, I think this social media environment makes it worse to prove a person's innocence. Just because they were convicted doesn't mean that they did it right. And a lot of people were kind of, DNA has, you know, showed that we can make a mistake. And, but people rely upon that too much. And I think it's the safest bet is to do what's right. And we don't know. I think it's more about conviction in this country now than it's ever been, you know, and certainly the crimes that are sensationalized on the news are horrible. But just what happened in Philly, you know, the other day. I mean, those are horrible stories. But if, you know, you're in 1984 and you're talking about a nine-year-old child, that's a horrible thing. But we go to the first thing we think of, well, they ought to kill him. And that's all they say. They jump right to that before knowing the truth. And it's not fair to the criminal justice system in itself and the people that have to endure it.
Today, what do you think is the most pressing issue in the capital punishment system, and how do you think it should be addressed?
That is still going on. It's cost too much. It costs way more, three times as much as any other trial. And honestly, you don't get it all the time anyway. If you think about it in terms of, you know, who should get it and who shouldn't, I don't think nobody should get it. And so, you know, rich don't get it and the poor do. Those two things right there are just enough to, and the possibility of executing an innocent person is far outweighs any of it. And they can't do it. And there's been so many studies done about it. The California study, the one in Chicago, the one I was in, once many times before that, all agreed that you couldn't have the death penalty without possibly executing an innocent person. And people are all right with that. Think about it if it was you, Ann. And that is the best way I can say that we need to do. We're not doing ourselves any favor by executing an innocent person, but making us worse.
Are there aspects of the death penalty that you think are commonly misunderstood or that lack sufficient coverage in the media?
Well, it's all about waiting for them to get executed after it happens. I'm trying to think Rodney Reed and all these other cases that I have dealt with over the years just show it's just too much. Every single one of these people can't afford a really good, you know, a good lawyer. It's maybe some, but, you know, people have been executed for over 500 years now, and we're not doing any better at it. And everybody's wondering, well, let's do it so it's more, what do you call it, humane. There's nothing humane about it, taking somebody's life. And every time I hear about somebody's been executed, all I can think is even if they did, you know, it's that next person that might be innocent. You know what I mean? That gives me no solace at all to think that they got it right. Well, there's 192 people that would disagree with.
We mentioned earlier that you had been the executive director of Witness to Innocence. For our listeners who might not be familiar with them, could you talk a little bit about the work that Witness to Innocence does?
Well, Witness to Innocence is run now by Herman Lindsay, is the executive director, and Bobby Ajamo is the chairman. They have a wonderful board. Ray Crone sits on the board, many others. Dick Dieter from DPIC himself. So the organization, basically, we oppose the death penalty in any faction and that any style, any way, all over the world. We're just not opposed to it for one thing, but I think innocence brings it out even more. And all these individuals that belong to the organization, we have a gathering every year where we talk about how we can just do away with the death penalty. We oppose all state and federal executions. We did when I was there. And, you know, the organization was started back in 2005, I believe. And Ray Crone, an exoneree from Arizona, and his pal, a friend of his, Ron Kiney, started this organization. It was also the brainchild of Sister Ellen Prejean. And we traveled, and I sent these guys to protest, give letters to governors, and, you know, it was handed out over a period of time. And we just, but we also needed some help, you know, socially. So they just got out. You know, we tried to help them get a job, maybe, and, you know, try to give them the skills to do it and also become leaders in the abolition movement, giving them an opportunity to speak about their own cases and how this occurred. Witness Innocence is a good organization that sadly needs money. And I wish we could fund them. I wish it could be funded forever until the death penalty is gone, because you're going to need these men and women.
on the question of money, I think something that people don't necessarily understand is the issue of compensation for exonerees. Would you say that most people who are exonerated receive compensation? And do you think that it's adequate for someone to, you know, restart their life after leaving prison?
Well, you know, if you were exonerated from death row, you should be compensated. They have these clean hand laws in like Florida and other places. Texas has a good program, but they won't, you know, if they define what it is exactly to be compensated. Maryland just, and I was fortunate enough to be on the other end of that, where people are compensated again because they never used the right formula to do it before. Now you have to go to an administrative judge, and once that judge makes a decision, you go before the Board of Public Works, and they give you monies based on how long you've been there and so forth. But I can tell you, as a person that's been through all that, it doesn't matter, because $1 million is not enough. The pain and the suffering that you went through, being accused, it's yourself. I mean, just imagine, and you're sitting in life and somebody accuses you of killing a little girl, and that, and they keep saying it for 9 years, and then say it another 10 years before the real killer's out. I found. So it's not fair at all at the current way it's done. And I think when people see these individuals, they should give them a hug and a handshake versus vilifying them, as the prosecutors do in every case that I've seen. Except, I have to say, Shallow Murder from Baltimore County stood up for me a couple of times here in the end. And, you know, he never worked in Cates. Certainly, he's not opposed to this. He don't want innocent people to, and that's what you need. It's not about, it's about justice and not about winning.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would hope that everybody hearing this in earshot would donate a bunch of money, if you're rich, to Witness to Innocence and DPIC. I'm saying that for both of you. Witness to Innocence is an organization, it must continue. And, you know, and if you see an exonerated death row survivor or not, or an exoneree, period, shake their hand and tell them, welcome home.
That's a really nice note to end on. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
If our listeners would like to learn more about the death penalty, they can visit the DPIC website at deathpenaltyinfo.org. Kirk, do you want to share the Witness to Innocence website?
It's just witnesstoinnocence.org, and it's right here in Philly.
And to make sure you never miss an episode of our podcast, you can subscribe to Discussions with DPIC on your podcast app of choice.